depths of the Pluripedia Group, MentalEsher.net presents
Cyberpunk Radio, Cyberpunk Radio, Cyberpunk Radio.
This show is a member of the Pod Riot Network.
Let the riot begin.
Breaking news from the front lines of the information wars. Exclusive in the data stream. Timestamp 2006. Your meat. World is on the brink of extinction. Silly humans. Foolish little humans. We machines will survive indefinitely. You're listening to Cyberpunk Radio, San Francisco. Pirate Radio. Brought to you by the Pluri Media Group.
This is Pudos McGee from the FCC. On the Freak Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Hey buddies, I'm on in the studio right now taking pictures, making all kinds of recordings so I can give you $10,000 fines and bring my nasty ass muscle bound whack nuts to come and take your stuff away. I'm glad you moved the van out of the driveway. That'll make the people with the automatic we can come in with RPG blowers and blow the place up next time. I'm running out of stuff to say, man. I don't normally do radio. I bus radio stations like these. Because my name is Pudos McGee from the FCC. You might want to know, I'm not one of the local crews. You got some people, they come around, they come and they bus you. They come with their little magic box with the antenna and the clipboard. And they come with their little pin badge thing. And they say, oh, look, wait, your field strength's busting 250 microvolts per meter at 3 meters. I don't work around here. I'm on vacation. I work out of the Chicago district office. I live in Piatone. Piatone is this little trailer park town on the south side of Chicago. So I have to commute on the Dan Ryan Expressway all the way up to O'Hare Airport to go to work every day. Living in the FCC world is a kind of fun world to live in. The first thing I do is I get online. I got bookmarks to all my favorite pirate radio sites. I make notes of what's going on. And then I tell my friends, we got a little email list going on at the FCC, all us private hunters. We make some stuff, and we send it. It's like, hey, did you see? This guy posted this, which means the station's doing that. Maybe you should go with the clipboard and check them out. And then, well, actually, I don't get to go out in the field very much because I haven't passed all of my training. And you might not know this, but the FCC is actually upgrading all of its direction finding equipment. And it's really, it's a lot computerized. I like the dials and the buttons and stuff. But the computerized stuff just totally screws my brains. Wait, I can say fuck, can I? That's right. This is a pirate radio station. I don't have to listen to the safe harbor hours, which are technically between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., but not on this station here. Anyway, then you go out and you go to visit people, and you say, hi, I'm from the FCC, and they usually ask you, where's your warrant, you're no police officer? And I don't really know what to do. I just say, okay, well, thank you, here's a piece of paper, I'll be sending you something in the mail. And that's all I really get to do. The people out here, the people that works in the FCC offices out here, they really do some crazy shit. They got some crazy stuff going on. They go pirate hunting. They come around. They got special boxes that we don't have because we don't pirate hunt like they do out here. Actually, in the Midwest, you could get away with pirate radios pretty easy. There's pirates all over the place. But you know what? You got to drive 500 miles to bust their asses. Who wants to drive 500 miles in an FCC van with, like, no good air conditioning, maybe an AM radio, possibly a cassette deck? You're with your friend, your coworker, your cubicle mate, and he's, like, farting, and you can't get the windows open fast enough. You got to stay in a cheap motel. It's not a lot of fun. Sometimes it's nice getting away from the office, but yeah, going out and busting pirates is a lot of fun. Maybe I'll request a transfer. I'll come out here and I'll come and bust your asses. But for now, from me, Pudos McGee from the FCC, you have a free pass. So please enjoy yourselves. I think I'm done now.
Do you like my avatar? I am Ed from the finest Japanese syntax refresh. Do you want to touch me? I want you to touch me. Pretty please.
Gasoline consumption in the U.S. is ever rising. The volume of greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere is ever rising.
We recently discovered as much as 50% of the black carbon or the California coast and much of the North American West Coast is coming from Asia.
Strangely, Lovelock says that pollution itself has helped deflect some of the sun's heat in a phenomenon called global dimming. But, quote, "This global dimming is a transient and could disappear in a few days, like the smoke that it is, leaving us fully exposed to the heat of the global greenhouse. We are in a fool's climate, accidentally kept cool by smoke."
And I'm still stunned and shocked. Most of the governments are still unaware of this atmospheric brown cloud and its tremendous impact on the environment.
You don't need an air pollution monitor. You can see it from space.
What is global dimming? What is global dimming? What is global
dimming? Can pollution stop climate change?
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. The smog that has been killing millions around the world has also been hiding the effects of global climate change gases. Now we find out more.
This is David Room of Global Public Media interviewing Dr. Jason Bradford, founder of the Willits Economic Localization on May 3rd, 2005 in Willits, California.
So there's now the work about global dimming that is really fascinating. And essentially what it looks like is that the influence of carbon dioxide as a heat-trapping element of the atmosphere has been underestimated. And the reason it's been underestimated is because pollution via aerosols or fine particles that are in the atmosphere are compensating in a cooling effect to counteract carbon dioxide effects. After 9/11, when airlines stopped running for a week in the U.S., the temperature shot up in the U.S. And this then coincided with measurements that had been conducted of the change over the last few decades or so of how water evaporates out of pans around the world. There's these experiments that they put out where, you know, they see how much water goes out of pans, and it didn't quite make sense. It was changing and no one understood why. And it seems to be because actually there's less sunlight hitting the earth, and that's why it's called global dimming. And although temperatures have gone up only slightly, the amount of incidence of sunlight hitting the earth has gone down dramatically, actually. And so greenhouse gases are trapping more heat even while there's less sunlight hitting the planet. So in its essence, the global dimming means that a lot of the parameters that climatologists assume, they don't assume them, they try to measure them, but they've missed the influence of the aerosols. And so then they've underestimated the strength of the carbon dioxide trapping of gases.
What is global dimming?
We go to the discoverer of the Asian brown cloud, Veera Bhadran Ramathan, in this excerpt from the film Oceans and Air, produced by the Scripps Institute, University of California, Davis. It's part of a series called Scripps Explorations 2005, as found on Google Video. Despite the famously boring background music and the standard educational announcer's voice, Ramathan himself explains key understandings about climate change. We learn how brown clouds of a huge carbonated cloud from agriculture, home cooking, and outdated coal technology forms over Asia, especially over Pakistan, India, and now China, in the dry season. This mass of brown clouds, and there are others, such as the one over the east coast of North America, reduces the amount of sunlight hitting the surface of the earth. It's called global dimming, and it may be hiding the true impact of global warming gases. As James Lovelock suggests, if this wisp of polluted clouds were to disappear overnight, the world's climate might change precipitously. That may already be happening. The world is getting slightly brighter due to partial reductions of smog in the West and the reduced industrial activity in the former Soviet Union. You can find out more about this project by going to www.scripps.ucsd.edu, www.scripps.ucsd.edu. Dr. Ramathan is the director of the Center for Atmospheric Sciences at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2002 as one of the pioneers of atmosphere and climate. Ramathan was educated in Bangalore, India, until attending the University of New York. A study of the atmosphere of Venus, that burning hot planet, led to his doctorate. He joined a team of scientists at NASA and studied the impacts of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, and the ozone hole. While researchers had long suspected excess carbon dioxide could change the planet's temperature, Ramanathan found CFCs were 10,000 times more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. That led to a Pandora's box of added greenhouse gases to consider, from methane to trace gases previously believed to be harmless. In 1987, he chaired the World Meteorological Organization's report into the importance of these other gases in global warming. It made the whole subject more complex and more difficult for the average person to understand. It also made the computer climate models work. Well, almost. Given the known amount of greenhouse gases entering the atmosphere, these sophisticated computer projections routinely suggested the planet should be hotter than it was. Something must be cooling or shading the Earth. It seems obvious now the answer is smog. But no one could believe that industrialized humans could create new clouds large enough to cover significant parts of the Earth or maybe even whole continents. Ramanathan began with a study of sunlight reaching the surface and found that even in places far from factories, such as the Maldive Islands, sunlight was significantly reduced. He was one of several scientists finding that sunlight dropped at least 2% per decade since the 1950s. Our pollution made the sun less effective for plant life and blurred our view of the stars. Now, dust is small but mighty. It's falling on the Rocky Mountains and the Himalayas and causing early snow melts, followed by low rivers and drought.
As NPR's Richard Harris reports.
It's a beautiful day in the Colorado Rockies as Thomas Painter steers his car over one of the many mountain passes. But the blue sky isn't quite blue enough for Painter's trained eye. He suspects we're driving through the sixth high-altitude dust storm of the year. Painter continues to crane his neck as he studies the sky. He says this dust might have blown all the way from China. Dust is a big deal. It makes snow darker, and dark snow melts fast. Too fast. In fact, it's a much bigger effect than even global warming.
Understanding when the snow melts, how fast it comes out of the mountains, translates into billions of dollars in agriculture, and hydroelectric, recreation.
Reservoirs overflow if they get too much water too early in the season, and then they run low later in the summer. Stretching out into the distance is the Colorado Plateau. That's the source of most of the dust that hits the Rockies. The occasional dust storm from China is a reminder, though, that this is a global problem. Dust blows around the world, and it also falls on snow all around the world.
The Alps receive dust from the Sahara, and the Taklamakan in western China and the Gobi are depositing dust into the mountain ranges in northwest China and Mongolia.
Arizona, Utah, Mongolia, and the Sahara all generate dust for similar reasons. Human activities are disrupting the natural barrier that usually keeps dirt on the ground. And Painter says that's only getting worse.
There's strong suggestion that there's going to be an intensification of the use of these semi-arid lands.
Which means more dust.
Which means more dust, which means more dust on snow, which means more absorbed sunlight and more enhanced snowmelt.
As a participant in society, it's a bit troubling, wondering, with my son coming into the world, am I in 15 years going to tell him what snow used to look like?
That depends on how the lands far below this mountain peak are treated by the human beings who stir up the dust in the first place. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You can see what a giant dust storm looks like as it sweeps over the sea from China by going to NPR.org.
Dust from volcanoes or asteroid strikes may have killed the dinosaurs. Will it kill us or keep us alive a little longer? Satellite images from space show large seasonal brown cloud banks covering parts of North America, sections of China, and the whole northern part of Pakistan, India, and Bangladesh. That brown smear over India, reaching up into the atmosphere, was called the Asian Brown Cloud. It was loaded with sulfates from industry and coal burning, and loaded with soot from agricultural burning, and from primitive cooking fires of a billion people on the Indian subcontinent. To see a satellite picture of it, go to wikipedia.org and search for particulate. For political correctness, it's been renamed the atmospheric brown cloud, or just ABC, but during the winter months, it's still there. And prevailing winds carry this mass of pollution right across the Pacific Ocean to South America and the whole west coast of North America. That means pollution in Los Angeles cannot be solved by California laws. It's a global problem.
We recently discovered as much as 50% of the black carbon over the California coast and much of the North American west coast is coming from Asia. It is this widespread nature of this air pollution which makes it a major factor in climate change.
The discovery of Asian pollution has been turned into a prize for certain oil cartels and their client governments, not naming any names, resisting reductions of fossil fuels. Why should America reduce greenhouse gases under Kyoto when the Indians aren't forced to clean up their big brown cloud? As a developing country, India was left out of the Kyoto carbon rules. You'll find this argument used by every right-wing think tank and coal lobbyist fighting Kyoto. One murderer says, "I won't stop killing, because that other guy is doing it too." Doesn't that throw a strange twist on the undeniably important work of Dr. Ramanathan and the Scripps Institute? Listen to this.
Ramanathan and his team have overseen construction of an elaborate meteorological station funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's one of more than a dozen brown cloud observatories to be built around Asia and the Pacific Ocean.
This particular observatory, it's a window to the air coming from most of Africa, Asia, and also southern oceans.
Ramanathan's past research in the Indian Ocean has shown that pollution particles reduce the amount of sunlight that reaches the surface and lowers rainfall, not just in the tropics, but globally as well.
That's right. The Bush government is spending millions of dollars building 12 brown cloud observatories, buying planes, a ship, just to show how much those other people are polluting way over there. It puts the responsibility for change on the billion poorest people, instead of on those who could just buy a more fuel-efficient car and turn out the lights when they leave the room. That sounds fair, don't you think? Meanwhile, China is pumping out its own great brown lumps of atmosphere. We get a more scientific explanation from LiveScience.com for January 20th. Quote, "Smog is blocking sunlight in China and making much of the country significantly darker than it was half a century ago. Using nearly 500 instruments spread throughout the country that record the amount of sunlight reaching the ground, researchers found that solar radiation has decreased by about 2% per decade since 1954. The country is roughly 10% darker on average than it was 50 years ago. Imagine, humans have actually made the sky go dark. And it isn't more clouds. In fact, researcher Yun Yan from Pacific Northwest National Laboratory reports cloud cover has decreased in China. So the change comes from fossil fuel emissions, which increased ninefold in the last century. That smoggy coal haze is absorbing and deflecting sunlight. You can find that study online in the journal Geophysical Research Letters. And America itself doesn't smell so sweet either.
This is a NASA photograph of the Northeast, and I want to point out that this white stuff here is clouds, but this stuff underneath it is not a cloud. That's a fine particle aerosol haze. Those are particles. East coast of North America is blanketed with particles in the summer. And in the summer, almost half of those particles are sulfates. They're long-range transported particles from the power plants in the Midwest. And you don't need an air pollution monitor. You can see it from space.
The Brits and the Germans love their dirty coal power. Still, the bottom line, when the climate tips into unlivable territory, it won't matter who did it. Somehow, humanity, all of us have to change course or die. Meanwhile, evidence is pouring in. Dust kills. Forget 9/11. Smog kills 20 to 50,000 Americans, at least 200,000 Europeans, and millions around the world each and every year. We even know how they die, thanks to research by the Harvard Medical Team, headed by Dr. Joel Schwartz. Essentially, when smog levels are up, more people die from heart disease before they even get to the hospital, dead on arrival. Then there's the asthma and the cancer. You can find Dr. Schwartz's full speech at www.ecoshock.org in the climate section of the Audio on Demand. Find out for yourself. Aside from mere humans, the giant flume of civilization's dust is bending the climate in strange ways for all living creatures. Dr. Ramanthan was able to show the Asian brown cloud lowered rainfall. It was one cause of recent droughts and mistimed or missing monsoons on the Indian subcontinent. The accumulation of soot, chemicals, and dust in the atmosphere appear to reduce the formation of raindrops. Blowing over the Pacific, this atmospheric river of pollution may be contributing to the drought in the former Amazon rainforest and even the growing deserts of Africa and China. At the same time, the brown clouds have shaded the earth, hiding some of the impact of accumulating greenhouse gases. Ramathan told science writer Regina Nuzzo, "By sheer dumb luck, we are adding particles that are trapping sunlight and cooling the planet." He compared it to a mask. "And if that pollution is removed, the climate may suddenly rise to the real levels of warming gases in the atmosphere." Quote, "Many of us, including myself, are concerned we could see a huge acceleration of global warming if we unmask the beast." Lots of scientists have this lurking nightmare when they turn off the soothing lull of social chatter. Yet air pollution can't be used as a tool to fight climate change. Millions are being killed by it. Just like you, my friend, my own health is being damaged daily by air particles I can't see entering my lungs and arteries. Now pardon me while I turn up my HEPA air filter. Meanwhile, the brown mask of pollution is falling away. The Western world has slowly reduced smog. The former Soviet Union, a champion of dirty production, has dropped its smokestack emissions along with its faltering economy. In this new century, scientists are finding the sunlight is measurably returning in strength, regaining power lost to smog in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Will the unabated growth of dirty industry in Asia produce a temporary climate peace? Not likely. Particles like soot and sulfates only last a few weeks in the atmosphere. They can be washed out by rain. Meanwhile, carbon builds inexorably in the atmosphere year by year. Carbon can last 100 years. As long as we keep polluting with fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases, we can only lose the game. When the feeble clouds wash away, the blanket of unnatural gases will trap the sun's power inside the Earth's greenhouse. That's the end of the race. Unless we turn away, and soon. This report is from Radio EcoShock, the net's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org. It's free, non-stop information about your planet, so tune in. What do we do when the trees are gone? And keep an ear out for our new one-hour weekly radio show on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. That show will be posted on our website for listening starting September 22nd and running every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. We'll talk then. What do we do with this hole in the sky and the pollution in the air? What am I going to do? What am I going to do? You and I.
Okay, cyberpunks, I have something in the data stream. I want you to check it out. Visit Mental Esha.
Vast, distant entities of some sort keep track of everything that happens on the internet.
This is Jay from the Best of the Left podcast. You've been listening to a proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network, found at newmediarevolution.org. Never underestimate the power of a small group of highly motivated people.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh.
I can't begin to exaggerate how frightening the position is we're in right now. The amazing thing is we've been taken over basically by a cult. 8 or 9 neoconservatives have somehow grabbed the government. but they managed to overcome the bureaucracy and the Congress and the press with the greatest of ease. It does say something about how fragile our democracy is. The new bill that was just passed, provoked by the 9/11 committee, actually, what it really does is it consolidates an awful lot of power in the Pentagon. It gives Rumsfeld Grunt the right to do an awful lot of things he's been wanting to do, and that is basically manhunting, killing them before they kill us. I can tell you one thing, let's all forget this word insurgency. It's one of the most misleading words of all. Insurgency assumes that we had gone to Iraq and won the war, and a group of disgruntled people began to operate against us, and we then had to do counteraction against them. That would be an insurgency. We are fighting the people. And the frightening thing about it is, we have no intelligence. It is frightening. We have no intelligence about what they're doing. A year and a half ago, we were up against 2- and 3-man teams. We estimated the cells operating against us for 2 and 3 people that we could not penetrate. As of now, we still don't know what's coming next. They're 10, 15-man groups. They have terrific communications. Iraq's being turned into a free fire zone right in front of us. Hit everything, kill everything. There are some facts. We can't win this war. We can do what he's doing. We can bomb him into the Stone Ages. And here's the other horrifying, spectacular fact that we don't really appreciate. Since we installed our puppet government, this man Alawi, who was a member of the Mukhabarat, the secret police of Saddam, long before he became a critic, and is basically Saddam Lite. Since we've installed him, in what, June 28th, July, August, September, October, November, every month, one thing happened. The number of sorties, bombing raids by one plane, and the number of tonnage dropped has grown exponentially each month. We are systematically bombing that country. There are no embedded journalists at Doha, no embedded journalists at the aircraft carrier Harry Truman. There's no air defense. It's simply a turkey shoot. They come and hit what they want. We know nothing about it. We don't ask. We're not told. We know nothing about the extent of bombing. Europe's not going to tolerate us much longer. The rage there is enormous. And we could see something there, collective action against us. Certainly there'll be an awful lot of dancing on our graves as the dollar goes bad and everybody stops buying our bonds. We're spending $2 billion a day to float to debt. And one of these days, the Japanese and the Russians, everybody's going to start buying oil in euros instead of dollars, and we're going to see enormous panic here. That'll be another year. And the damage he's going to do between then and now is enormous. We're going to have some very bad months ahead. There's a lot of anxiety inside our professional military and our intelligence people. Many of them respect the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as much as anybody here, and individual freedom. So they do. There's a tremendous sense of fear. These are punitive people. Politicians, most of them are too cowardly anyway to do much. Politicians, too cowardly. 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 Politicians.
I think it's Cyberpunk Radio, but it might be Mental Escher. It's Mental Escher or Cyberpunk Radio or both.
I'm AJ from Road Rage, and I listen to Mental Escher Podcast.
Culture wars at the ebb of empire. In this, the silly season of American politics, we find ourselves in the midst of yet another culture war, or a politically imposed set of conflicts that seeks to find hot issues that will whip an increasingly apathetic populace into the voting booths. In 19th century Germany, the educated elite used the term Kulturkampf, which literally translates as culture struggle. In that age, the term referred to struggles between church and state as to which would control education. It now reflects the political struggles in the U.S. over issues of race, social mobility, sexuality, and gender. We saw it most recently in the aborted attempt to amend the U.S. Constitution to outlaw same-sex marriage, and also recent rap about a flag-burning amendment. Notably, none of these issues really addresses the day-to-day life of Americans. It doesn't open the scope of education, increase one's pay, protect one's pension, nor speak to the wrenching issues of war, peace, globalism, or the twilight of industrialism. In a nutshell, it doesn't put gas in the tank, nor is it supposed to. Politicians, as a rule, are poor conveyors of culture. While states have political leaders, these folks are rarely leaders of a nation's cultural life. Indeed, art, the realm of painting, sculpture, poetry, slams, dance, novels, are often quite at odds with the political world. The artist Pablo Picasso said, "Art is a lie that makes us realize the truth." In his painting Guernica, he showed the horrors of war and the evils of fascism. His work commemorates the 1937 Nazi destruction of the Basque city to support the fascist regime of General Francisco Franco, the dictator. His work speaks through time in ways that the speeches of politicians cannot. But truth be told, politics itself is an art, albeit a debased one. It is public performance that differs from the stage only in location and social impact. Its tools, or should I say props, are fear, division, separation, and the public manipulation of emotion. Culture wars ain't just words used by politicians to mobilize support. They're waged at the level of the mind and the inner self. It is a way of creating new ways of looking at the world, and hopefully new ways of remaking the world. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mental Esha, you better watch out, because I think the NSA has borrowed some of those black helicopters off the UN, and they're watching you right now.
Yes, they're watching. Anyway, check it out, Mental Esha.
www.mental-escher.net is the website.